Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
When we've been there 10,000 years.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm John Donvan, in for Tam Ashbrook, and this is On Point. And the folk hymn Amazing Grace was originally published in 1779 and has since become one of the most famous English hymns. It's been sung by Judy Collins, Willie Nelson, Mahalia Jackson, Barack Obama. And now a new Broadway musical looks at the man who wrote this famous song, John Newton. Remarkably, Newton was a slave trader who remarkably then became an abolitionist. This hour, On Point, the new musical and the story behind Amazing Grace. You can join us on air or online. Do you know this story? And what is your favorite version of Amazing Grace? And what is the song meant for you? We are at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Well, joining me now from New York is Chris Smith. He is the creator, the composer, the lyricist, the co-author of the new Broadway musical, Amazing Grace. He spent 17 years putting this musical together. Previously, he was a police officer and a youth outreach and educational director in Montgomery County, Pennsylvania. Chris Smith, welcome to On Point. Congratulations on your musical.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
We have three fascinating stories to tell here. One is the story of this song, one is the story of the man who wrote it, and one is the story of the man who wrote the musical that's now running on Broadway, and that's you, Chris Smith. You were a cop. And now, you're writing musicals. What did you tell us the story? And when did you figure out how to write a musical?
Well, I had sort of played around. You know, I play guitar. I teach myself pretty much everything I do. So, I taught myself to play guitar, and I would write little songs, and I'd work for my church and things like this kind of thing. But it all changed one day when I found a book in a library about John Newton. I had no idea who he was. And I pulled the book off the shelf at random and started reading it. And what unfolded before me was this story of a slave trader who basically turned his back on the slave trade and blew the lid off the entire thing. He actually became sort of the world's first whistleblower. And I was just captivated. And I went home to my wife and I said, this is a musical. This has got to be a musical. We checked. No one had done it. 260 years, no one had done it. And she said, you do it. Do it yourself. And the odyssey, which those few words caused, has been going on ever since.
What year was that you found that book?
That was 1997.
And at that point, you were still a serving police officer at that point, or had you moved on?
I had switched. Well, I became a police officer again after that also. I sort of worked in youth and family outreach, and then I would switch to police officer, and I'd go back and forth. So sometimes I'd be full-time, sometimes I'd be part-time. But, so at that moment, I was actually running a youth hockey league for a local church.
And you're in Bucks County, Pennsylvania. It's not the big city. And you knew, I've already alluded to this, you knew not very much about how to write a musical or even how to write a song, I think.
No, everything was experiential. But I will say this, Bucks County, there must be something in the water because Oscar Hammerstein, Stephen Sondheim were from there. So there's a rich history of it. But what I knew experientially. And what I had to do was really become the listener I needed to be to work with the other professionals in this industry, all of whom are at the top level. And I went in really deciding that what I had to be was a great student and a flexible writer. And that's what took all those years, and that's what got us to where we are.
You had nobody – it sounds like you had nobody in your life saying, this is crazy, don't even try. You had the opposite.
Well, my wife was the only one who always believed in it. Even I had moments of doubt. And there were other people. But I also had a number of investors from Bucks County that I went to early on who believed in it, invested in it, and made it possible for me to do full time. And they also, throughout all the ups and downs that you can imagine, going to Goodspeed Opera House, going to Chicago, and then coming to Broadway, they have been just immensely supportive throughout.
Chris, take us through a little bit, just for a minute, a little bit of your process of writing songs as somebody who didn't know how to read music, I guess, or understand chord structure and harmony. All that. How did you figure it out?
When I was very young, my parents were divorced when I was very young, and my mother had bipolar disease. And it was a very difficult childhood, and I was very withdrawn. And I used to sort of withdraw into music. And all I can say is that somehow the music must have imprinted on my brain. Because when I experience music, when I invent it, I hear it all together at once with the lyrics. You know, I see scenes, I see people all together. And then what I really have to do is I have to sort of pull on these threads in order to bring out, you know, what needs to go here, what needs to go there. If it was 30 years ago, before the age of computers, I'm not sure I could have done it, because I rely on computers very heavily to record my different thoughts and put them together to make a whole.
Did you watch a whole lot of other shows at that point? Were you learning from?
I did. Once when my producer brought me in, we actually found a mentor for me, Arthur Jerome, who has mentored a whole generation of playwrights at Carnegie Mellon University. And we literally went to every musical on Broadway that year and learned a lot of what we should do, shouldn't do. And, you know, as I said, it's a process. I read somewhere that I discovered that I was a writer. That's not true at all. I became a writer. I had to learn everything from the ground up.
And I want to remind our listeners, we're talking about a show that is now on Broadway. I mean, this was very do-it-yourself, and the show is there now, called Amazing Grace. So let's talk about your main character. You've already talked a little bit about discovering the story of John Newton in a book and finding out that it I don't think most people know it. Obviously, some did because there was a book about it. You read that book, but there certainly wasn't a show about it. But what did you learn about John Newton that surprised you? And tell us a little about his time and place.
John Newton lived in the 1700s, in the mid-1700s, at a time when slavery was legal in Britain and the slave trade was a roaring industry. It was as big as the oil industry is today. And it was about as vital as the oil industry is today, too. So to speak against slavery was to really speak against economic prosperity. And John Newton was born into a family of slave traders, and he went into the business and went into it with a fervor. He was a strong atheist, very vocal, outspoken atheist, and a very bitter person. He lost his mother at an early age, and it sort of drove this desire to be a super slave trader and to really be the best at this evil enterprise. And then at one point on a long voyage back from Africa, where he had for a time actually been enslaved himself and got just a little bit of a taste of what he had been doing to others, there was a tremendous hurricane. He was sure he was going to die, and he actually tied himself to the wheel of the ship and was ready to go down with the ship and finally cried out to God for mercy, and that changed everything in his life from that point forward.
What did he do then?
Then he went and he actually got out of the slave trade. It took more time than we show in the musical. In the musical, everything is condensed. Mm-hmm. But like most life changes, it took time. He got out of the slave trade. He got a job on land. And then he started writing hymns. And he started working in a church. And he eventually became a pastor and a preacher, basically, and a hymnist, and spent the rest of his life serving.
Tell us about the character Thomas in the musical. Who was Thomas really in John Newton's life?
Thomas is actually a conglomeration of many different characters. He's based mostly on Adula Equiano, who we have a very good diary of from around that time. And he knew John Newton. He knew William Wilberforce. But what I always wanted to do was have sort of a fly on the wall in history. I wanted to see history from the inside. And Thomas is a way to do that. So I sort of gave John a slave that would follow him throughout the entire journey and mm-hmm. could see his moral decline and could actually call him on some of the things that he was doing and be sort of a moral barometer. But to do that, I had to create a character and I had to find reasons for him to be through, you know, with John throughout the story.
And what happens between the two of them?
Well, at one point, John, after he is enslaved himself and Thomas is with him, John is actually told to sell Thomas. And he must then go and sell this person who has been loyal to him all his life and who has sort of been a father figure to him. John's father wasn't really there for him. And Thomas was. And Thomas, like I say, has been this person, this guiding influence. And Johnny has to sell him. And explodes into a huge scene, and he actually winds up whipping this man who he loves, and he actually does send him off to Barbados, which was practically a death sentence. You got to remember Thomas had already made one middle passage, so this was his second middle passage, and then after John's conversion, after he suddenly wakes up morally. And spiritually, he realizes he's got to find him. So he goes across the ocean and sets off in search of this man that he did such wrong to.
How does the audience react to that whipping scene?
With horror. Mm. It was extremely hard to write. It's very hard to watch. But it's necessary. It's necessary. You know, a lot of times we listen to Amazing Grace, we hear that saved a wretch like me. It seems a little alien. What is a wretch? We had to really show the audience that slavery was personal. It was real people that you could know, that you could see, and it was real violence committed against them. And we had to do that in a way which was obviously safe for the actors and respectful for what's going on in the show and the audience, but we had to show it in a real way.
Chris Smith, please hang on. He is the creator, the composer, the lyricist of the new Broadway musical Amazing Grace, and we are going out to break listening to the full company of that show singing We Are Determined. You can join our conversation. What do you know about the story of John Newton, the man who wrote Amazing Grace, and why has this song endured? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm John Donvan, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm John Donvan, in for Tom Ashbrook, and we are talking with Chris Smith, the creator, composer, lyricist of the new Broadway musical, Amazing Grace. And we're hearing it to the sound of the Soweto Gospel Choir. You can join our conversation. For you, is Amazing Grace a song of hope or redemption? Has it been there for you in hard times? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, and you can also follow us on Twitter and follow us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Chris Smith, we were talking about, I had wanted to play a little bit of the song you composed for that difficult scene that you wrote about, yes. Where Chuck Cooper, playing the role of Thomas, while he's just after he's been whipped by John Newton, sings to him very, very powerfully like this.
You know no one's ever leaving here unjust. So there's only one real question now before your time on this troubled earth is done. When they lay your body in the ground, where will you go when there's nowhere left to run?
Very very accusatory lyrics. I mean, really fingering John Newton as not being a good man at that point.
No.
And I want to ask you how Newton reflected that in himself, in the actual lyrics and the writing of Amazing Grace. Talk to us about, you know, the beginning of that song. It's John Newton is quite self-accusatory.
Yeah, I think one of the appeals of the song is how honest he is about his own condition. And one of the things that really helps Amazing Grace to span cultures, to span generations, ages, is that it is what it is. It's honest. And it really takes an honest look at the human condition. That wasn't something that was done back in Newton's era. This was, you know, hymns were something that were very formal. They had a theological point. Or something that they were trying to expose. John Newton really laid it all out there and just said, this is what I am. This is what I've become, and this is why. And people just found it immensely appealing, as they do today.
I want to bring another voice into the conversation now. Joining us from Washington is Bill Carpenter, and he is a gospel music historian and author of On Cloudy Days, The Gospel Music Encyclopedia. Bill Carpenter, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, how are you?
We're great, thank you, and enjoying this conversation. I want to talk a little bit about, you know, once the song was let loose into the world, what was the route it took to the point where it became really, really the standard that it is today?
I think it floated around for about 60 years before the music that we now know it for was attached to it, from a song called New Britain. But then it was published many times in different hymn books. And then in the 20th century, it was recorded in 1922. And that sort of kicked off a series of religious figures like pastors at that time recording it. And, you know, it was adopted by the Civil Rights Movement. It was because of the redemption message in the song, I think it can apply to a lot of different things. And I think that's what makes it relevant in the 1700s and relevant in the 21st century as well, is because it's an eternal message. Whether you have faith or no faith, there's something about the redemptive quality of the song. We're humans. We make mistakes. Whether you're looking to God or to your brotherhood for forgiveness, that's what makes the song work. And I think that's what has made it continue to live on. I think that's what's so great about this musical is for people who don't like history or don't read history books, they're getting history, they're getting a show, and they're also getting a spiritual message.
We're asking our listeners to share with us the meaning of this song to them. Let's bring in some listeners now and bring in Stacy from Akron, Ohio. Stacy, welcome to On Point.
Hi, John.
Hi. So tell us, what does it mean to you? Go ahead.
Amazing Grace is my favorite song, and I always remember years ago being at a church where there was a young girl with Down syndrome, and when we sang Amazing Grace, how she started crying. And it touched me so much to know that not only was it my favorite song, but that this young girl that was such an innocent soul could just be so moved by its words and message. And I just want to thank you for bringing this song into Broadway as a musical.
Stacy, great.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. And thanks for sharing that, Stacy. Let's bring in Sarah from Bolton, Massachusetts. Sarah, welcome to On Point.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes, I saw the show last week in New York City on Tuesday night, and I have to say it was outstanding. It's the best musical I've ever seen. I was so moved. I couldn't even sing at the end when the audience was invited to sing Amazing Grace. It's just so much more the story of John Newton. It really is the personal story of bringing you in to see what slavery felt like, what it was like for the people at the time. And then there's the story of Christopher Smith. So I just can't say enough about it. It was just wonderful.
Thanks very much for your
thank
call
you.
To us, Sarah, and a very nice compliment to you, Chris Smith. Let's
yes,
listen to
thank you very much.
Let's listen to some renditions that we've heard and that we've loved over the years. Here's Mahalia Jackson. So that was a version from 1947. Now I want to jump forward to 2004, and after we hear the 2004 version, I'll tell you where that came from. Okay, credit on that goes to bagpiper Eric Rigler, and that was played at the 2004 burial ceremony for President Ronald Reagan. And I want to come back to you, Bill, and you know, Mahalia Jackson's version, 1947, and then subsequent versions by her and performances by Judy Collins became almost an anthem to the civil rights movement on the one hand, and then we have presidents being buried to it. And I want to say we looked this up. Several presidents have passed away in the last 20 to 30 years, at least two. I shouldn't say several, at least two have had Amazing Grace performed at their funerals. And what is it about this hymn that it bridges all of these purposes?
I think it goes back to the idea that we're all just humans. And we all make mistakes, and we're looking for redemption, whether we admit it publicly or secretly. And that song has that message. And I think Mahalia Jackson is somebody who came from, you know, poor means and fought her way to success and could relate to the song. But, you know, successful people can relate to it. What did I have to do to get to where I got in business or in life? And I think that's what really makes it resonate.
It also strikes me that this piece of music, despite its widespread use, has avoided becoming trivialized and hackneyed. You know, where it's I don't believe it's showing up in commercials on television. It has somehow preserved its integrity. And again, that's a tough question, Bill. Why?
Right. Well, I think it's like the Star Spangled Banner, you know, at these baseball games when some celebrity goes up like Roseanne Barr and sort of butchers it and people get very offended. I think Amazing Grace is like that. I think it's one of those songs you don't mess with unless you can really sing. And then it's like it's the world's anthem, not just America. I mean, the song is popular all over the world, especially in America, but it's just something about the song that is sacred to people.
Mm. Let's bring in Martha from Lenox, Mass. Martha, welcome to On Point.
Hi, John.
Hi.
And thank you for this show about Amazing Grace. I think in a way it represents any of us who come out of the depths and sort of cry for help. But I did see the show a couple of weeks ago in New York. And to me, the power in it comes from what President Obama called the original sin of our country, which is slavery. And to see a slave auction in front of your eyes was so, so shocking and so powerful and just transforming. And, you know, we were all in tears throughout the whole show. The black characters particularly are just so powerful and so well-defined. And it's I'm going to go back and see it again. I've never had an experience like it in the theater. And I just want to thank Christopher Smith and the whole cast. It's a wonderful, wonderful show. And Amazing Grace will never be the same.
Chris, I have to let you respond to some of these. Yeah, how are you handling this
well,
praise?
Well, you can see that there was a lot to live up to for the very for just what you were asking Bill about. you know, when you try and tell a story that is so deep into our culture in so many different ways, you really have to rise above and tell a story which is immensely entertaining, yet immensely meaningful, and that takes into account the sacred nature that the song has in people's lives. So it was a lot to live up to. A lot of it is our director, Gabriel Barry, our music director, Joe Church. We really worked for years and years trying to find the right balance between showing you an honest portrayal of that world and yet coming out feeling inspired, feeling empowered, so that it wasn't something that dragged you down. It was something that set you off on a course to do something in your own world.
Chris, you are getting unbelievably rave reviews from our listeners, but I know that some of the professional critics out there had challenges to what you did, particularly a while back. A Chicago critic really challenged the notion he didn't make it so explicit, but the tone of it was, here's a white writer taking on the issue of slavery and making it a story about a white man and his personal transformation and the institution of slavery plays second fiddle. And I've read also that you were sensitive to criticisms all along the way as part of your learning process, and that you took these things seriously and you made adjustments. So what about that whole side of it?
We had to widen our view. I personally had to widen my view. John Newton's autobiography is about his experience and what he went through, and it's from his perspective. But we're telling a much bigger story here. So I really had to open my arms wider and really embrace each of the African characters and their experience and their journey and tell the story from their point of view as well. And I think that was it was a valid criticism. It was something that we took to heart and we worked on very hard. And I think, you're hearing from listeners that what we've come up with here on Broadway is definitely something that's solved that, for sure.
What's an example of an adjustment that you made to your script or to your book, by which I mean the lyrics of the play, that reflected that learning process for you?
Well, just the point of view. I mean, the autobiography is written, of course, by Newton himself about himself. We decided that what we wanted to do was have Thomas, whose African name is Pakuta, and we wanted to have him be our point of view character. And he would come out and he would sort of make a case for why this story should be told, why it should be told now, and sort of his involvement in it. So we begin with that. We end with his summation. And then throughout, we learn about his journey and how he got to be there and how his influence, represents the African experience throughout John Newton's life.
Let's go to Eliza calling from Boston. Eliza, welcome to On Point.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to share, I love hearing this story and I have to go see the show. But I wanted to share with you and your listeners that several years ago, I was the captain of a ship called the Amistad that circumnavigated the Atlantic, and we heard Amazing Grace in every single port we went to.
Oh, interesting.
The bagpipes in England, and then in Africa, we heard it in Portugal, we heard it in Barbados. But probably the most moving version that I get all shaky about even talking about was when, in the middle of crossing from Sierra Leone over to Barbados, we did a ceremony to the Middle Passage. And it was just myself and the crew. We had a part Sierra Leonean crew. And one of our Sierra Leonean crew members, Sam, sang it a cappella on the stern of a sailing ship, and it was heartbreaking.
Eliza, thank you for your call. That's very, very powerful. I want to hear a little bit more from the Broadway musical Amazing Grace. This is a song called Truly Alive. It's sung by Josh Young, who plays John Newton, and Tom Hewitt, who plays his father. And as we listen, we're with the creator of the Broadway musical Amazing Grace, Chris Smith, and with gospel historian Bill Carpenter. So stay with us, both of you, please. And you can join our conversation. What is your favorite version of Amazing Grace, and What's your question for the cast of the new musical, Amazing Grace? Because we're going to be talking to two of them shortly. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm John Donvan, and for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.
Tell me my business. It's not enough to dream about your life the way you wish it could be. So let me prove I am a man who can stand against the sea. You will see that to be truly alive.
You don't know what you're asking for, Johnny. There is more to this world than what you believe. Yes, I am still by my father. Why can't you see
it's up
that
to me.
I know what you
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes.
And a new day slowly begins. Soon the sun is shining bright.
This is On Point. I'm John Donvan in for Tom Ashbrook, and we are talking about the new musical Amazing Grace, which is about the man who wrote the famous song. You can join our conversation. Why is the song still so prominent 200 years after it was written? And what do you make of the story of its genesis now that you're hearing it from our guest, Chris Smith? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And you can also follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. And we're coming into the song that is Daybreak. You've been hearing from the Broadway musical Amazing Grace, and it is performed by Leona Michelle, who plays Nana, and will be joining us in just a moment. We are talking with Chris Smith, the creator, composer, and lyricist of the program, of the show, and gospel historian Bill Carpenter. And now joining us also from New York is Josh Young. He's a Tony nominee, starring in Amazing Grace on Broadway as John Newton. He's also performed in Jesus Christ Superstar, Evita, Kiss Me Kate, Les Miserables, and West Side Story. Josh Young, welcome to On Point.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
And also Leona Michelle, whom we just heard singing. She plays the character of Nana, a slave that works for the love interest of the main character, John Newton. Leona Michelle, welcome also to On Point.
Thank you very much.
Josh, let's listen to some of Amazing Grace and the song Testimony, which is where you really hear the depth of John Newton's religious faith as well as the depth of his shame for his previous behavior. Let's listen to a little bit of that.
And the man that I was, I cast upon the fury of the sea. Let the wind and the waves wash away the fool I used to be. And I won't be ashamed to stand and proclaim I am free. I am free. And I never can repay what the Lord forgave this day. He came for me. Came to set me free.
Wow, Josh Young, nice moment. Wow, how do you feel about John Newton, this character you're playing?
I feel he sets a great example for humanity, kind of, that that anyone can change, you know, and I think that's a great message. I think that's the – I think I personally feel that's the most important message of our show, that no matter your sins, you can be forgiven and you can change and you can be a cause for good in the world, which John was. So it's a real honor to get to play this guy who sets this example.
How did you prepare for the role?
Well, luckily, John kept journals throughout his life, and they're all available to be read. There's been many biographies written on John. And he also his wife kept all the letters that he wrote to her, and they have compiled them in a book titled Letters to a Wife. So I have all those to draw from. So there's a lot that we know about him, and that's really a gift for an actor.
We have some interesting identity issues sort of floating through the story here, given in your case that you're Jewish and you're playing a story – you're playing a man who takes this very, very deep dive into Christianity. And in fact, you've played as Judas in Jesus Christ Superstar these largely Christian themes. Is that a complicated thing for you, or is acting just acting?
It's not complicated at all. I mean, in Jesus Christ Superstar, Judas, he in the show, he's doubting who Jesus says he is. And to be completely honest, as a Jewish person, that's something that I struggle with. Mm-hmm. And however, in this show, it's really what we're presenting is John seeing the error of his ways and realizing that there is a God who watches over him, and there is a God that can be forgiving, and there is a God that will light his path towards enlightenment, and who will watch over him as he makes this decision to fight against slavery. And I can totally sign up for that as a human being, Jewish or not.
And Leona Michel, talk to us about the character Nana. You have called her the most complex character you've ever played. Why is that?
Yes, I did call her that, and I do believe that, because this character for me was one that I would normally shy away from. As a young actress, I've always felt like, oh boy, I don't want to have to go into those roles of playing slaves for the rest of my life. I am an African-American actress, and I want to play different roles, leading ladies and princesses, of course, and queens and all these, and be the Juliets and not the nurses. But when this role was placed in my lap, it has really been a labor of love and great gratitude. I based her off of my personal grandmother, who worked the majority of her life as a maid, and my maternal grandmother was a missionary. So it was a gift to be able to infuse this role of Nana with both of those people in my personal life, and just infuse it so that to create this character of Nana. And thankfully, the room was very gracious to me. Christopher Smith was he worked very closely with me, with helping me to give this voice in honesty.
And you helped to workshop the script and the role itself, and that means basically you ran these things in front of audiences in small groups and in front of each other, and you know, let's change this, let's change that, and you were very active in that process in regard to Nana. So how did the character of Nana change through that process, and how did you affect the change?
The change for me really happened when I started to, you know, you get the script and the first thing you do is you say, how do I identify with this role? And that's my way in, finding the similarities of how I can find a voice for this character. But the biggest change had been for me is exploring the internal life. You know, Nana is one of the silent witnesses on the stage. And there's so many Nanas in this world that don't have a voice. Mm-hmm. And so as we begin to develop this character, from Chicago, of the Bank of America Theater, there was a scene that the character was in and then she was taken out of. And, you know, I pulled back and I said, oh, you know what? This makes a lot of sense. I don't need to speak in these scenes because I need to be a silent witness. So just the careful way the director and the writing team, Chris Smith, have finessed the script, it just made so much sense, and it's been so much fun exploring an internal life.
And you heard earlier, Chris and I were talking about some of the critique that came earlier in the process about the portrayal and the placement of slavery and of the African-American characters. How do you feel the musical deals with slavery on the whole?
I'm sorry. Can you repeat that? I thought you were talking to Chris.
Oh, no, no. Oh, you mean you weren't listening to my every word at every moment?
I was reflecting on my internal life.
How do you feel that the musical deals with the topic of slavery?
For me, the topic of slavery, this is a story about John Newton's life, and the atmosphere just so happens to be that it's set during slavery. And so I know that a lot of African-American audience come and go, oh, I wanted more of this, I wanted more of that. And I say, whoa, this is the story of John Newton. We're telling this man's story through this lens. And it just so happens to be that it took place during this particular period. And so slavery is the bed that the life of this story takes place. And it changes the temperature of the room as John navigates through the story. So, yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Let's bring in Terry from Cleveland, Ohio. Terry's one of our listeners. Thanks for joining us on Point, Terry.
Yeah. Hi, John.
Hi.
I heard a story from African-American pastor and singer Whitney Phipps that the song, the melody, the tune of Amazing Grace was that of the slaves themselves. It was their mournful humming, their tune, their possible cultural song that they sang in Newton's Slave Ship. And I was wondering if anyone had heard this story.
That's an interesting question to you, Bill Carpenter, because you mentioned to us that the song was in search of a melody for 60 or 70 years before it settled on the one that we know today. So you know, the question Terry's raising is the melody meant to sort of reflect something mournful about the condition of slavery? Do you know much about that?
Absolutely. Well, first of all, a lot of people think that the song was born based on that shipwreck experience, and that it wasn't written until several years after that, after he had reconverted back to Christianity and changed his life course. So it was written just as a something for Sunday morning, basically, and then. We don't really know what the melody was at that time, but, you know, about 60 years later, the melody that's now associated with it was put with it. I've never heard that it was based on slave moaning or anything like that. Mm-hmm. It's very possible. I mean, because a lot of this information wasn't written down. So it's anybody's guess.
Let's bring in Kathleen from Potsdam, New York. Kathleen, welcome to On Point.
Hi, thanks.
Sure.
I'm calling in because Amazing Grace is just really special to me, and I had two thoughts about it. One is I grew up with it in church, and it had two lyrics that I learned. One was the lyric that saved a wretch like me, and the other was, and saved and set me free. And both are really poignant, and I sing both. And then another, I wanted to relate a story. I had to go into a treatment center for alcoholism, and I am a singer, and I met up with another singer while there, and we got together and we were singing Amazing Grace, and some of the other people being treated there heard us, and it ended up being requested of us that we sing to them when they were being released from the treatment center, and we sang Amazing Grace as people were being released, and we harmonized it, and it became... we sang it regularly, and it was really, really moving to know that they were going on to this new life as we sang that to them.
Oh, lovely, lovely story, Kathleen, and it goes to the point that it would come up again and again of redemption. But I'm curious about what you said about, to take it to Chris Smith, the fact that there are publications that have two different lyrics, Saved a Wretch Like Me, or what is the alternate version? Saved and Set Me Free.
Yeah, Wretch Like Me is the original, and I guess some people felt that that was a little less accessible just because we don't use the word wretch a whole lot. Mm-hmm. But there are actually, even in the musical, we have lyrics that were subsequently added to the story. When We've Been There 10,000 Years was not original. And we wanted to reflect not just the song that John wrote originally, but the place it's had over the years and in so many lives and in so many generations. So we wanted to perform the full song. And then in the question of the melody, we do take the view that it was actually from an African slave melody. We take a little license there because we sort of have the song grow throughout the show in John's mind as the as the themes develop throughout the show in John's mind, which is very satisfying to the audience. And whether it's true, I guess we'll never know.
Let's bring in Christine from Twinsburg, Ohio. Christine, welcome to On Point.
Hi, John.
Hi.
I just wanted to share an experience that that I had, how this song has touched my life. My husband and I did Civil War reenacting all through the 90s. And after, you know, I got a little bored with the soldier thing, I started to research the social history, the home front history, and what the women were doing, which, of course, led to music because it was such a huge part of their lives. And every time we went to an event, there was a Sunday service, and Amazing Grace was sung. I wasn't familiar with this song because I grew up in a different denomination. But both of us, my husband and myself, really came to love this song, especially the subsequent verses, because the lyrically, it's just a masterpiece, let alone the very moving tune.
It's interesting. So, thanks, Christine, for your call. It's interesting, Chris Smith, we usually don't get down to the lower verses, but did you make full use of the of everything in the show?
We do five. We do five verses, and they're the ones that most people know, although there's one that's not quite as common. But we wanted to give as much as we could and yet keep things, you know, moving, because obviously we want to get through the curtain call. We want to have a chance for everyone to sing. One of the most moving things about Amazing Grace on Broadway is to hear everybody singing together, a whole room full of people singing Amazing Grace. It's brilliant.
Well, let's all of us get out of the way so that we can hear a little bit of that as we finish the program. But Chris Smith, creator, lyricist of the musical Amazing Grace, thank you. Good luck. Bill Carpenter, gospel historian, thank you. Josh Young, Leona Michelle, good luck and congratulations. Here is the finale, actually, to the Amazing Grace, Josh Young singing as John Newton, along with everybody else on the stage. And this is On Point. I'm John Donvan.
Was love.